First things first, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy, with Stephen R. Covey. Stephen R. Covey is the founder and chairman of the Covey Leadership Center and the nonprofit Institute for Principle-Centered Leadership. In this breakthrough program, Dr. Covey applies the insights of the 7 habits of highly effective people to the conflicting daily demands with which we all struggle. Instead of using traditional time management techniques to help us cope with our lives, Dr. Covey shows us how to discover what is truly important in life and teaches us how to dedicate our energy to the goals and principles which bring inner peace and fulfillment. Here is Stephen R. Covey.
I would like to begin by acknowledging that First Things First is the work of 3 people, Roger Merrill, Rebecca Merrill, and myself. Roger is a well-known leader in time management and leadership development. He's also a vice president and a founding member of the Covey Leadership Center. Rebecca has served in numerous leadership positions in community, education, and women's organizations. Together, they wrote Connections, subtitled Quadrant 2 Time Management, and they raised a beautiful family. The ideas I'll be presenting in this program are the result of the synergy and the work we've done together. If you were to pause and think seriously about the first things in your life, that is, the 3 or 4 things that matter most to you, what would they be? Now ask yourself, are these things receiving the care, the emphasis, the time you really want to give them? These are tough questions. Through our work at the Covey Leadership Center, we've come in contact with literally thousands of people from around the world, and we're constantly impressed with what they represent. They're active, hard-working, competent, caring people, dedicated to making a difference. Yet these people consistently tell us of the tremendous struggles they face daily while trying to put first things first in their lives. Why is it that so often our first things aren't first? I mean, really, for years we've been given methods, techniques, tools, information on how to manage and control our time. We've been told that if we keep working harder, or learn to do things better, or faster, or smarter, or use some new device or tool, or organize in a particular way, then we'll be able to do it all. So we buy the new planner, go to the new class, read the new book. We learn it, apply it, try harder, and what happens? For many people, the result is increased frustration and guilt. You see, traditional time management suggests that by doing things more efficiently, you'll eventually gain control of your life, and that the increased control will bring peace of mind and fulfillment that you're looking for. We disagree in a most fundamental sense. During this audio program, I will present ideas that represent a fundamental break with traditional ways of thinking about time management, about life balance, and achievement. As you know, in every field of human endeavor, all of the significant breakthroughs were break-withs, that is, breaking with old ways of thinking. So also in the field of time management. We are going to present a principle-centered paradigm, a principle-centered approach that transcends the traditional prescriptions of faster, harder, smarter. In one sense, this approach is new, but in another, it's very old. It's deeply rooted in classic, timeless principles that represent a distinct contrast to the quick-fix, wealth-without-work approach to life promoted by so much of the current time literature and the success literature. We live in a modern society that loves shortcut techniques. Yet we learn over and over again that quality of life cannot be achieved by taking the right shortcut. Why? Because simply there is no shortcut, but there is a path. If you want to get the most out of the material on this program, you will need to really become involved with it. That is, in a very deep way. You'll need to examine your life, your scripts, your motives, your first things, and what you represent. This is a highly introspective process. As you listen to the material, I encourage you to pause frequently and listen to your own mind and heart. It's impossible to get deeply absorbed in this kind of profound self-knowledge and not emerge unchanged. Literally, you'll end up seeing the world differently. You'll see relationships differently. You'll see time differently. You'll see yourself differently. We are convinced that this material can empower you to close the gap between what's deeply important to you and the way you spend your time. The power is in the principles. The clock and the compass. How many people on their deathbed wished they'd spent more time at the office? My daughter Maria, who recently had a baby, was talking with me one evening. She said, "I'm so frustrated, Dad. You know how much I love this baby, but I'm just not getting anything else done." I could understand how this was so frustrating to her. Maria is bright and capable. She's always been involved in many good things. She was being pulled by good things, projects she wanted to accomplish, contributions she wanted to make, things around the house that weren't getting done. As we talked, we came to the realization that her frustration was essentially a result of her expectations, over which she had control. And for now, only one thing was needful: enjoying that baby. I told her to just relax. Relax and enjoy the nature of this new experience. Let this infant feel your joy in the role of mother. No one else can love and nurture that child the way you can. All other interests pale in comparison for now. Maria came to realize that in the short run, her life was going to be imbalanced, and that it should be. There is a time and a season for everything under the sun. She also realized that as the baby grew and entered a different phase of life, that she would be able to reach her goals and contribute in other powerful ways. Finally, I suggested, "Maria, don't even keep a schedule. Forget your calendar. Throw away your planning tools. They only induce guilt. This baby is the first thing in your life right now. Just enjoy the baby. Don't worry. Be governed by your internal compass, not by some clock on the wall or some planner." Putting first things first is an issue at the very heart of life. Almost all of us feel torn by the things we want to do, by the demands placed on us, by the many responsibilities we hold. We all feel challenged by the day-to-day and moment-by-moment decisions we must make regarding the best use of our time. Decisions are easier when it's a question of good or bad. We can easily see how some ways we could spend our time are wasteful, mind-numbing, even destructive. But for most of us, the issue is not between good and bad, but between the good and the best. So often, and think deeply about this, the enemy of the best is the good. What is best for you? What unique gifts and abilities do you possess that you alone can give? What keeps you from giving those best things the time and energy you want to give them? Are too many good things getting in the way? For many people, they are. And the result is the unsettling feeling that they're not putting first things first in their lives. Our struggle to put first things first can be characterized by a simple contrast between two powerful tools, the clock and the compass. The clock represents our commitments, appointments, schedules, goals, activities, what we do with and how we manage our time. The compass represents our vision, values, principles, mission, conscience, direction, what we feel is important, and how we lead our lives. The struggle comes when we sense a gap between the clock and the compass, when what we do doesn't contribute to what is most important in our lives. We may be brought to an awareness of this gap in a dramatic way. Usually it's a crisis. A loved one dies. Suddenly she's gone, and we see the stark reality of what could have been but wasn't, because we were too busy climbing the ladder of success to cherish and nurture a deeply satisfying relationship. Or we may find out our teenage son is on drugs. Pictures flood our minds, times we could have spent through the years doing things together, sharing, building the relationships, but we didn't because we were too busy earning a living, making the right connections, or simply reading the newspaper. Or perhaps the company's downsizing and our job's on the line. Or we're told we just have a few months to live. Or our marriage is threatened by divorce. Some crisis brings us to an awareness that what we're doing with our time and what we feel is deeply important simply don't match. In the absence of such wake-up calls, many of us never really confront the critical issues of life. Instead of looking for deep chronic causes, we look for quick fix band-aid and aspirin approaches to treat the acute pain. Then we're fortified by a temporary relief, and then we get busier and busier, doing more good things, and never even stop to ask ourselves if what we're really doing matters most. Think deeply about the difference between a clock and a compass, because this symbolism expresses the essence of the break with the traditional approach in time management. In our effort to close the gap between the clock and the compass, many of us turn to the different fields of time management. You see, traditional time management focus is on achieving, accomplishing, getting what you want, not letting anything get in the way. Other people are essentially seen as resources through which you can get more done, faster, or perhaps as obstacles or even interruptions. Relationships are essentially transactional in this way of thinking. When we transact, we essentially buy gas and give money. When we transact with people, we get one thing and get something in return. But the reality is that most of the greatest achievements and the deepest joys in life come from relationships that are transformational, not transactional at all. In the very nature of the interaction, people are changed, they are altered, they are transformed. Something new is created, and neither person is controlling it. Neither could have even anticipated it. And it isn't due to efficiency. It comes from the exchange of understanding, from new insights, new learnings, and all the excitement that develops around all those new learnings. Time management itself is a management, not a leadership perspective. Management works within the system. Leadership works on the system. You manage things. You lead people. You manage cash. You lead people. You manage inventories, physical resources. You lead people. Fundamental to putting first things first in our lives is to put leadership before management. To ask the question, am I doing the right things? Before asking and answering the question, am I doing things right? The urgency addiction. If you think about it, there are two primary factors that drive our choices concerning how we use our time. One is urgency, the other is importance. Knowing and doing what's important rather than simply responding to what's urgent is without question the key to putting first things first. Some of us get so used to the adrenaline rush of handling crises that we become literally dependent upon it for a sense of excitement and energy. We get a temporary high from solving urgent and important crises. Many of the traditional time management tools actually feed the urgency addiction. Daily planning and to-do lists essentially keep us focused on prioritizing and doing the urgent. But the many important things that really contribute to our overall objectives and give richness and meaning to life don't tend to act upon us or press upon us at all. They are the things we must act upon. They are not urgent, but terribly important. In order to focus on the difference between urgency and importance, let's discuss the activity matrix, we call it, which characterizes our activities into four quadrants. Now, in your mind's eye, try to see a square divided into four equal parts. We'll call them quadrants. Quadrant 1, the upper left-hand quadrant, represents things that are both urgent and important. Here's where we handle an irate client, we meet a deadline, repair a broken-down machine, undergo heart surgery, or help a crying child who has been hurt. We need to spend time in Quadrant 1. This is where we manage, where we produce, where we bring our experience and judgment to bear in responding to the many needs and challenges which press upon us. Remember, Quadrant 1 is important. It is also urgent. On the other hand, Quadrant 2, the upper right-hand quadrant, includes activities that are important but not urgent. This is what we could call the quadrant of quality. Here's where we do our long-range planning, where we anticipate and prevent problems, where we broaden our mind and our skills through reading, through continuous professional development. Here's where we envision how we're going to help a struggling son or daughter. Here's where we prepare for important meetings. Here's where we invest in relationships through deep, honest listening. You see, Quadrant 2 does not act on us. We must act on it. It takes a high level of proactivity. This is the quadrant of personal leadership. Quadrant 3 is almost a phantom of Quadrant 1. It's the lower left-hand corner quadrant. It includes things that are urgent, but not important. In a sense, it is a quadrant of deception, because the noise of urgency creates the illusion of importance. But the actual activities, if they're important at all, are only important to someone else. Many phone calls, meetings, and drop-in visitors fall into this category. It is absolutely amazing to see the amount of time most people spend in Quadrant 3. Really, meeting other people's priorities and expectations, whether they're important or not, thinking we're in Quadrant 1. Let's look at Quadrant 4. It's the lower right-hand corner. It's reserved for those activities that are not urgent and not important. It is a quadrant of waste, really. We shouldn't even be there at all. But we can often get so battle-scarred from being tossed around in quadrants 1 and 3, that is, that which is truly urgent, whether important or not, that we often simply escape to quadrant 4 for survival. Quadrant 4 could be characterized by reading addictive light novels, habitually watching mindless television shows like a couch potato, or gossiping endlessly around the water fountain at the office. Other kinds of time wasters. Quadrant 4 is not survival, it's really deterioration. If you're like most people, you're probably spending the majority of your time in quadrants 1 and 3. And what's the cost? If urgency is driving you, the first things, the truly important things, are simply not receiving your time and attention. Think about these two questions. Think deeply. Think of one activity that you know that if you did it superbly well and consistently would have significant positive results in your personal life. The second question pertains to your professional life or your work life. What is the one activity that you know if you did superbly well and consistently that it would have significant positive results in your professional or work life? Now analyze what quadrants your answers are in. You'll find that they are in quadrant 2. They are all important, but not urgent. So why aren't we doing these quadrant 2 things? these things that are important, truly, deeply important, but not urgent, simply because they are not urgent. They aren't pressing on us. They may not be popular. They may not be proximate. They simply don't act on us. We have to act on them. As we move from urgency to importance, we encounter the fundamental question at hand. What are the first things, and how do we put them first in our lives and keep them there? Consider three fundamental ideas that empower us to answer this question. First, the fulfillment of the four human needs and capacities. Second, the reality of True North principles. And third, the capacity of the four human endowments. We're going to slowly develop each idea. The essence of the first idea, that is, the fulfillment of needs and capacities, is captured in the phrase, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. This represents the four basic needs in our life. The need to live is our physical need for such things as food, clothing, shelter, economic well-being, health, and so forth. The need to love is our social need to relate to other people, to love, to be loved, to belong, to be accepted. The need to learn is our mental need to grow, to develop, and to use those talents. And the need to leave a legacy in the use of those talents is our spiritual need. That is, to have a sense of meaning, to add value, to have a sense of purpose, a personal harmony and contribution. These needs are real and deep and highly interrelated. Some of us recognize that we have these needs, but we tend to see them as separate compartments of life. We think of balance as running from one area to another fast enough to spend time in each one on a regular basis. For example, we may see the physical need of earning a living as separate from our spiritual need to contribute to society. The work we choose to do may be monotonous, dull, and unfulfilling. It may even be counterproductive to society's welfare. Or let's say you have a problem in the social area. Maybe you're going through divorce. Attending to the physical, mental, and spiritual areas of your life may actually increase your ability to handle it. By exercising, for instance, and taking care of your health, by studying and learning more about the nature of relationships, by strengthening your sense of purpose and meaning in life, you nurture the very conditions that empower you to face the social, the relationship problem in the best possible way. Fulfilling the four needs in an integrated way is like combining elements in chemistry. When we reach a critical mass of integration, we experience spontaneous combustion, an explosion of inner synergy that ignites the fire within and gives vision, passion, and a spirit of adventure to life. The humility of principles. Just as important as fulfilling the four needs and capacities is the way we seek to fulfill them. Our ability to create quality of life is a function of the degree to which our lives are aligned with external natural laws we call principles. Now, unless you're driving, I'd like to ask you to close your eyes and point north. If you are driving, just think which way is north. When I ask people to do this in seminars, they're surprised when they open their eyes to see people pointing in every direction, including upward. What is north? Is it a matter of opinion? Is it something we should vote on? Is it subject to the democratic process? It is not a function of the democratic process at all. North is an external reality. So are these natural laws, these principles. It is absolutely independent of us. The reality of True North gives context and meaning to where we are, where we want to go, and how to get there. Without a compass or stars or a correct understanding of our location, we may have trouble locating it, but it is always there. without getting hung up on the technicalities of True North or Grid North or Magnetic North, we're going to use the concept of True North as a kind of symbol, a metaphor, for principles, for natural laws. Just as True North is real in the physical world, there are also timeless laws of cause and effect that operate in the world of personal effectiveness and human interaction. The collective wisdom of the ages reveals these principles as recurring themes, foundational to every great person, society or organization, every institution. When we talk about principles, it's important to know what we aren't talking about as well as what we are. We're not talking about values. We're not talking about practices. We're also not talking about religion. What we are talking about is what I call the law of the farm. One of the best ways to understand how the external realities of natural laws or principles govern is to consider the law of the farm. In agriculture, we can see easily and agree that natural laws and principles govern the work and determine the harvest. But in social, family, and corporate cultures, we somehow think we can dismiss natural processes, cheat the system, and still win the day. And there's a great deal of evidence that seems to support that belief. For example, did you ever cram in school, goof off during the semester, spend all night before the big test trying to cram a semester's worth of learning into your head? I'm ashamed to admit it, but I did. In fact, I crammed most of my way through undergraduate school thinking how clever I was. Then I got into graduate work, a different league altogether. I spent my first 3 or 4 months trying to cram to make up for 4 years of undergraduate cramming. I wound up in a hospital with ulcerated colitis. You see, I was trying to shortcut natural laws, and I found out that long-term you simply can't do it. And I've spent years trying to compensate for the foolishness of getting myself into a well-accepted social value system that was not tied to principles at all. Perhaps many of you learned the same lesson the hard way. Now, can you imagine cramming on the farm? Can you imagine forgetting to plant in the spring, flaking out all summer and heating it hard in the fall, ripping the soil up, throwing in the seeds, watering, cultivating, and expecting to get a bountiful harvest overnight? It's laughable. It's ludicrous. Cramming just doesn't work in a natural system. But in a social system, cramming may appear to work. That is, in the short term. You can go for the quick fixes with apparent success. But in the long run, the law of the farm governs in all arenas of life. I'm sure many of us wish now that we hadn't have crammed in school. We may have got the degree, but we didn't get the education. Eventually, we find out that there's a difference between succeeding in the social system of school and succeeding in the development of the mind, the ability to think analytically, to communicate orally and in writing, to rise above outmoded practices and solve problems in new and better ways. What about character? Can you cram and suddenly become a person of integrity, courage, and compassion? What about physical health? Can you overcome years of potato chip, chocolate cake, no exercise lifestyle by spending the night before the marathon working out at the health spa? What about a marriage? Many people who marry don't want to change their lifestyle at all. They're married singles. They don't take the time to nurture the seeds of shared vision, selflessness, caring, tenderness, and consideration. And yet they're often surprised at the harvest of weeds. In fact, what about any relationships, particularly relationships with children? We can take the shortcuts. I mean, we're bigger, smarter, we have the authority. We can talk down to them. We can threaten, impose our will. We can try to shift the responsibility for training them to schools, to churches, or daycare centers. But over time, the hens come home to roost. These shortcuts will not develop responsible, caring, wise adults empowered to make effective decisions and live happy, responsible, competent, contributing lives. In the short run, we may be able to go for the quick fix with apparent success. We can make impressions, we can put on the charm. We can learn manipulative techniques, that is, what lever to pull, what button to push, to get just the desired reaction. But in the long term, the law of the farm governs in every area of life. The third fundamental idea that helps us determine which things to put first is what we could call the capacity of the four human endowments. As human beings, we have unique endowments that distinguish us from the animal world. Let me identify four: self-awareness, conscience, creative imagination, and independent will. These four endowments reside in the space between stimulus and response, that is, between those things that happen to us and our response to them. These endowments create our ultimate human freedom, that is, the power to choose, to respond, to change. The proper use of all four endowments literally empowers us to align our lives with true north. Let's look at each one in turn. The first, self-awareness. This basically is our capacity to stand apart from ourselves, to examine our own thinking, our motives, our history, our scripts, our actions, and our habits. The second is conscience. It connects us with the wisdom of the ages and the wisdom of the heart. It's our internal guidance system that allows us to sense when we act or even contemplate acting in a way that's contrary to principle. It is our deep moral sense. The third unique human endowment, independent will, is in our capacity to act. It gives us the power to transcend our scripts, our paradigms, the power to swim upstream if we so choose, to rewrite our scripts, to act based on principle rather than reacting based on emotion, mood, or circumstance. You see, we're not victims. We're not the product of our past. Those things influence us, but they do not determine us. We are a product of our choices to those things. We are response-able. That is, able to respond, to choose beyond our moods and tendencies. It simply takes willpower to act on the other three endowments: self-awareness, conscience, and vision. And finally, the fourth endowment is creative imagination. That is the power to envision a future state, to create something in our mind, to solve problems in new ways, synergistically, so that we're not a product of our past, of our memory. This is the endowment that enables us to see ourselves and others differently, better than we are now. It enables us to write personal mission statements, family mission statements, organizational mission statements. It empowers us to visualize ourselves living our mission statements, even in the most difficult and challenging circumstances. Now, building these endowments is a process of nurturing and exercising them on a continuing basis. Let me suggest some powerful ways to develop them and to cultivate the synergy among them. Keeping a personal journal is a very high-leverage Quadrant 2 activity that significantly increases self-awareness and enhances all of the endowments and the synergy among them. In other words, you observe your own involvement. That's self-awareness. What things would you write about in a personal journal? If you don't like a result you're getting in your life, write about it. Get it out on paper. Notice how the law of the harvest operates in your life. See how consequences flow from root causes. If you're not sure why you still do some things that you know are harmful or self-defeating, analyze it, process it, write it down. If your father did something that drove you nuts and you said to yourself, "When I'm a dad, I'm never going to do that," and then you find yourself doing it, write it down, look at it, observe. Doing so will help you make wise choices. Second, you can educate your conscience by learning, listening, and responding to it. The existence of the conscience is one of the most widely validated concepts in psychological, sociological, religious, and philosophical literature throughout all time. From the wisdom literature's inner voice to psychology's collective unconscious, this endowment of our conscience, this moral sense, has been recognized and addressed as a major part of human beings. We can educate our conscience in these ways. We can read and ponder over the wisdom literature of the ages to broaden our awareness of the true north principles that run as common themes throughout all time. We can stand apart from and learn from our own experiences. We can carefully observe the experiences of others. Most importantly, we can take time to be still and to listen to our deep inner voice, and then to respond to that voice, to act in harmony with that voice. The third endowment we are calling the independent will. The finest way I know to strengthen our own willpower is to learn to make and keep promises. Each time we do, we make deposits into our personal integrity account. This is a metaphor that describes the amount of trust we have in ourselves, in our ability to walk our talk. Integrity, therefore, is the opinion we have of ourselves. It's important to start small. Make and keep a promise, even if it means you're going to get up in the morning a little earlier and exercise. Even if it means you aren't going to watch television tonight. Instead, to read. Be sure you don't violate that commitment, and be sure you don't overpromise and underdeliver. Build slowly until your sense of honor becomes greater than your moods. It will level out the ups and downs of your emotional life, simply because your honor is greater than your moods. One time I remember counseling with a man whose life was totally broken. It was filled with all kinds of sloppiness and flakiness. Like a flying fish that would occasionally shimmer into the sunlight, he would himself put in appearances from time to time, and then he would plow right back into a life of procrastination and selfishness, buffeted by all the urgent things that were afflicting him. I began to encourage this man to tap into his unique human endowments and to start in very small ways. I counseled, "Will you get up in the morning when you say you're planning to get up? Will you simply get up in the morning?" He said, "How is that going to affect everything else?" I said, "Your body is the only instrument through which you operate in life. If you don't get control of your body, how can you control the expressions that come through your body and your mind?" He said, "I really don't know if I can." I said, "Do you think you could for a week?" He said, "Yes, I think I could for a week." "Will you get up at the time you decide you're planning to get up and do it for one entire week?" He said, "I will." I saw him a week later. "Did you do it?" "I did." "Congratulations," I said. "Already your life is getting integrated at a very small level. Now what's the next thing you're going to commit to do?" Little by little, this man began to make and keep commitments, promises to himself. No one else knew of his plan, but a friend and myself who were encouraging him. We began to see absolutely remarkable change. His emotional life before had been like a roller coaster. His decisions were a function of circumstances and mood. He would make a promise and it felt great, but when the mood and the circumstance were discouraging, he would get low and then break it. And something inside him would break too, his integrity. But little by little, as he began the process of making and keeping small promises, his emotional life absolutely evened out. He found that making and keeping promises to himself increased his ability to make and keep promises to others as well. He discovered that his lack of integrity had been a great impediment in his relationships with other people. Out of his private victories, public victories, that is, relationship victories, began to come. Finally, let's see how we can develop our creative imagination. I suggest the essential process is the use of visualization. Visualization is a high-leverage mental exercise used by world-class athletes and performers. But instead of using it to improve your tennis game or your concert performance, we suggest you try using it to nurture the endowments and improve the quality of your very life. Set aside time to be alone, away from interruptions. Close your eyes and visualize yourself in some circumstance that would normally create discomfort or pain. But instead of seeing yourself react as you normally do, see yourself act based on the principles you are convinced will create results. See yourself interacting with others in a way that combines courage and consideration. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Now let's take a closer look at the process of putting first things first, what we call a quadrant two organizing process. Let me take you through a series of steps in creating this process. Step one, first, connect with your vision and mission. As you begin to organize for the coming week, the first step is to connect with what's most important in your life as a whole. Context gives meaning. Consider the big picture, what you care about, what makes the moments in your life meaningful. The key to this connection lies in the clarity of your vision around such questions as, what is most important? What gives my life meaning? What do I want to be and to do in my life? What kind of a person? What kind of contributions do I want to make? Many people capture their answers to such questions in a written personal creed or a mission statement. Such statements capture what you want to be and what you want to do in your life, and also the principles that you value, upon which being and doing are based. If you don't have a personal mission statement now, you may get some feeling of what's important to you by doing the following. List the three or four things you could consider the first things in your life. Consider any long-range goals you might have set. Think about the most important relationships in your life and the most important responsibilities. Think about any contributions you'd like to make. Reaffirm the feelings you want to have in your life, such as peace, confidence, happiness, meaning, contribution. Think about how you would like to spend the coming week if you knew you only had 6 months to live. In other words, try to connect with your inner compass as well as true north in order to think about what really matters most in your life. If you do have a mission statement, review it now before you decide how to spend the next 7 days of your life. Remember, reconnect with the things that are deeply important to you. And another reason why a mission statement can have such a powerful influence on us is because it establishes and taps into the passion and power of vision. Let's think a little about the passion of vision. Viktor Frankl, an Austrian psychologist who survived the death camps of Nazi Germany, made a very significant discovery. As he found within himself the capacity to rise above his humiliating circumstances, he became an observer as well as a participant in the experience. He watched others who shared in the ordeal. He became absolutely intrigued with the question of what it was that made it possible for some to survive when others didn't. They died. He looked at several factors: their health, their vitality, their family structure, their intelligence, their survival skills. Finally, after study and observation, he concluded that none of these factors was primarily responsible for survival. The single most significant factor, he realized, was a sense of future vision, a sense of meaning, the impelling conviction that they had a mission yet to perform, some important work left to do. Survivors of POW camps in Vietnam and elsewhere have reported similar experiences. A compelling, future-oriented vision is the primary force that kept many of them alive. The power of vision is absolutely remarkable. Research indicates that children with future-focused role images perform far better scholastically and are significantly more competent in handling the challenges of life. Teams and organizations with a strong sense of mission significantly outperform those without the strength of vision. Vision is the highest manifestation of creative imagination and the primary motivation of human action. It's the ability to see beyond our present reality, to create, to invent what does not yet exist, to become what we are not yet. It gives us the capacity to live out of our imagination instead of our memory. Vision clarifies purpose, gives direction, and empowers us to perform beyond our resources. It's the energy that makes life an adventure, the deep burning yes that empowers us to say no, peacefully, confidently, smilingly, to the less important things in our lives. This passion of vision can empower us literally to transcend fear, doubt, discouragement, and many other things that keep us from accomplishment and contribution. Consider Gandhi, for example. He came from a background of timidity, scarcity, jealousy, fear, and insecurity. He basically didn't even want to be with people. He wanted to be alone. But as he began to see the injustices against the Indian people, a vision was born in his mind and heart. He saw how he could help the Indian people transform their image of themselves as inferior to their British overlords and develop a sense of their own self-worth. As he focused on his vision, his personality weaknesses were essentially eclipsed, subordinated. Vision and purpose created personality growth and development. He wanted to love people, to serve people, to be with people. His highest wish was to help redeem a nation. As a result, he eventually brought England to its knees and liberated 300 million people. Near the end of his life, he remarked, "I am convinced that I have not done one thing that anyone else could do if they could get deeply immersed in some vision, some purpose that transcends self." Now, what if you were able to take that vision, ensure that it was grounded in True North principles and connected with your deepest inner imperatives, shape it into words, thoroughly refine it, use it as a basis for weekly Quadrant 2 organizing, memorize it, envision its fulfillment, write it in your mind and heart so that it literally became a constitution, the frame of reference that literally governed every decision, every relationship, your entire life. Once we have a mission statement, we can use our creative imagination to visualize ourselves living it. Today at work, tonight when we come home, when we're tired, when our expectations haven't been met, when we're disappointed. We can use our minds to face and creatively solve the most difficult challenges to our integrity. We can act instead of being acted upon. Creating and integrating an empowering personal mission statement is simply one of the most powerful and important Quadrant 2 investments we can ever make. Now let us move on to Step 2. Identify your roles. You see, we live our lives in terms of roles. We have important roles at work, in the family, in the community, and in other areas of life. Our roles represent our responsibilities, our relationships, our areas of contribution. Much of our pain in life comes from the sense that we're succeeding in one role at the expense of another, even more important roles. We may be doing great as a vice president of the company, but not well at all as a parent or spouse. We may be succeeding in meeting the needs of our clients, but failing to meet our own need for personal development and growth. A clear set of roles provides a natural framework to create order and balance. Balance among roles does not simply mean that you're spending time in each role, but that these roles work together for the accomplishment of your mission. Take a moment to think about the primary roles in your life. Perhaps you may define your family role as simply family member. Or you may choose to divide it into two roles, husband and father, wife and mother, or daughter and sister. Some areas of your life, such as your job, may involve several roles. You may have one role in administration, one in marketing, one in personnel, and one in long-range planning. You may also want to have one role that reflects personal development. Identifying roles gives a sense of the wholeness of a quality life, that life is more than just a job or a family or a particular relationship. It's all of these together. In addition to the roles that you've identified, I'd like to suggest a separate role called sharpen the saw. It's a role that everyone has and is foundational for success in every other role. The term sharpen the saw is a metaphor that describes the energy we invest in increasing our personal capacity in the four fundamental areas, that is, the physical, the social, the mental, and the spiritual. We often get so busy sawing, that is, producing results, that we forget to sharpen our saw, that is, to maintain or to increase our capacity to continue to produce results in the future. Some people use their sharpen the saw role for organizing weekly investment activities, such as daily exercise or personal reading. It's important to realize that all of these roles are not distinct departments of life. They form a highly interrelated whole. By identifying your roles, you're not trying to break your life down and to fit it into neat little boxes on a planning page. You're creating a variety of perspectives from which to examine your life to ensure balance and harmony. The paradigm is always one of importance, of interdependence, of relatedness, and of balance. Past time management tools focused almost entirely on prioritization, not on balance. Probably the deepest and most often expressed pain we hear in the area of time management comes from this imbalance. Really, many, many people feel torn and guilt-ridden in the seeming conflict. The most frequently mentioned conflict is between work and family roles, and the most often expressed pain is in relationships and the lack of personal development. People are saying, "I simply can't run fast enough to touch all the bases in my life every day. Some important things in my life just aren't getting done. The faster I run, the more out of balance I feel." People often neglect their loved ones, their health, their integrity, all in the name of some other goal. Their single-minded purpose has created deep imbalance. How do we nurture this balance in our lives? Is it simply a matter of running between bases fast enough to touch them all every day? Or is there some other more effective way to see the whole situation that might create a more powerful impact on the results we're getting in our lives? Take a moment and reconsider the roles you identified just a few moments ago. How do you see these roles? Many of us in the Western world are programmed from an early age to see them as separate compartments of life. We go to different classes in school, we have separate subjects, we have separate textbooks. We get an A in biology and a C in history, and it never crosses our mind that there's any relationship between the two. We see our role at work as completely separate from our role at home, and neither as having much to do with other roles such as personal development or community service. As a result, we think in terms of either or. That's called dichotomistic thinking. We focus on one role or on another. In a very real sense, therefore, the way we see the problem is the problem. This compartmentalization is based on an illusion, and to try to live the illusion is incredibly strenuous. Gandhi once said, "A person cannot do right in one department of life, whilst attempting to do wrong in another department. Life is one indivisible whole." In reality, these roles are parts of a highly interrelated whole, a living ecosystem in which each impacts every other part. This inter-role synergy saves an enormous amount of problem-solving time and energy. This synergy empowers us to develop in terms of, let's say, fulfilling a personal development goal to exercise, and your goal as a parent to build a relationship with a teenage daughter by taking that daughter out for a game of tennis. If we need to inspect a factory and train a new assistant, we can see inspecting the factory together as a way to train that assistant. Understanding this synergy helps us to transcend either-or dichotomies. A woman who chooses to have children and to be with them can transcend the painful mentality, the dichotomy of children or career. She becomes energized by the vision of her mothering role as a significant contribution to society. She develops character and competence that empower her to fulfill other roles as well. Our roles are like the branches of a living tree. They grow naturally out of a common trunk, which is our mission, and the unique fulfillment of our needs and capacities. And they grow out of common roots, the principles that give sustenance in life. Our roles become the channels through which we live, love, learn, and leave a legacy. Let us move on to step 3 in the quadrant 2 organizing process. Remember, the first step dealt with the development of a mission statement. The second step, the development of our roles. The third step is to select quadrant 2 goals in each role. With the framework of the roles that you've identified already, ask yourself this question. What is the most important thing I could do in this role this week to have the greatest positive impact? Consider the question again. Think of each role and ask this question. What is the most important thing I could do in this role this week to have the greatest positive impact? And remember, you look at the week through the context of the longer-term vision and your mission statement. Now, as you pause to consider the question, consult the wisdom of your heart as well as your mind. What do you feel would make a significant difference in each role? What about your role as a spouse, as a friend, as an employee? Listen to your conscience. Use your compass instead of the clock. Focus on importance rather than urgency. In the sharpen the saw area, physical goals might include regular exercise or proper diet. In the spiritual area, you might choose meditation, prayer, or the study of inspiring literature. You'll probably be aware of several goals you could set in each role, but you may feel, based on your own inner compass, that you should not set goals in every role this week, but rather focus on just one goal. The Quadrant 2 process allows for that flexibility and encourages you to use your compass in determining what's most important for you to do. All of this represents the power of goals. One of the most common elements of all self-help and management literature is the idea of the power of goals. We've been told to set long-term goals, short-term goals, daily goals, monthly goals, personal goals, organizational goals, 10-year goals, lifetime goals. Goal setting is obviously a very powerful process. It's based on the same law of focus that allows us to concentrate rays of diffused sunlight into a force powerful enough to start a fire. It's the manifestation of creative imagination and independent will. It's a common denominator of successful individuals and organizations. But without principles, goals will never have the power to produce quality of life results. You can want to do the right thing, and you can even want to do it for the right reasons. But if you don't apply the right principles, you will still hit a wall. A principle-centered goal is all three: the right thing for the right reason in the right way. Step 4, creating a decision-making framework for the week. Effectively translating high-leverage Quadrant 2 goals into an action plan requires creating a framework for effective decision-making throughout the week. Most people are constantly trying to find time for the important activities in their already overflowing Quadrant 1 and Quadrant 3 schedules. They move things around, delegate them, cancel them, postpone them, all in the hope of finding time for first things. The heart of this process is in organizing on a weekly rather than on a daily basis. The daily planning programs of traditional time management provide us with a very limited view. Because the perspective of the day is so close up, we're often kept focused on just what's in front of us. Urgency and efficiency tend to crowd out and dominate importance and effectiveness. Weekly organizing, on the other hand, provides a context to what we do. The activities of the day begin to take on more appropriate dimensions when viewed in the context of the entire week. One of my associates shared this experience. I attended a seminar once where the instructor was lecturing on time. At one point he said, "Okay, it's time for a quiz." He reached under the table and pulled out a wide-mouthed gallon jar. He set it on the table next to a platter with some fist-sized rocks on it. "How many of these rocks do you think we can get into the jar?" he asked. After we made our guess, he said, "Okay, let's find out." He set one rock in the jar and then another. I don't remember how many got in, but he got the jar completely full. Then he asked, "Is that jar full?" Everyone looked at the rocks and at the jar and said, "Yes." Then he said, "Ah." He reached under the table and pulled out a bucket of gravel. Then he dumped some gravel in and shook the jar, and the gravel went in all the little spaces left by the big rocks. Then he grinned and said once more, "Is the jar full?" By this time we were on to him. "Probably not," we said. "Good," he replied. And he reached under the table and brought out a bucket of sand. He started dumping the sand in, and it went in all the little spaces left by the rocks and the gravel. Once more he looked at us and said, "Is the jar now full?" "No," we all roared. He said, "Good," and he grabbed a pitcher of water and began to pour it in. He got something like a quart of water into that jar. Then he said, "Well, what's the point?" Someone said, "Well, there are gaps, and if you really work at it, you can always fit more into your life." "No," he said, "that's not the point at all. The point is this. If you hadn't have put those big rocks in first, would you ever have gotten any of them in?" Quadrant 2 goals are like the big rocks. If we put other activities, that is the water, the sand, and gravel, in first, and then try to fit the big rocks in, not only will they not fit, we'll end up making a pretty big mess in the process. But if we put the big rocks in first, it's amazing how many of them we can put in, and how much of the sand, gravel, and water fits in between the spaces. Regardless of what else actually does fit in, the key point is that the big rocks, that is, our Quadrant 2 goals, are in first. As Goethe put it, "Things that matter most must never be at the mercy of things that matter least." Step 5. Exercise integrity in the moment of choice. With important Quadrant 2 goals in place for the week, the real challenge is to keep first things first. Right in the middle of unexpected opportunities, needs, and challenges of the day. This requires tremendous integrity, or integratedness. We must exercise it. This means we must translate the mission to the very moment we're facing with peace and confidence. Whether it's putting first things first, or creating conscience-directed change, or in carrying out the plan that we've made, or whatever. Even in the selection of roles and goals, every decision is a moment. And the key is to exercise integrity in that very moment so that what we decide is totally in harmony with our conscience, with a well-educated, principle-centered conscience. The essence of all of the steps we've taken so far basically is to live true to our conscience in the moments of decision-making. This is exactly where the rubber meets the road. Whether it has to do with the selection of roles, or goals, or the execution of them. Step 6 basically is the evaluation step. You see, the Quadrant 2 process would be incomplete if we don't close the loop. Without turning the experience of 1 week into the foundation for increasing the effectiveness of the next. Unless we learn from living, how are we going to keep from doing the same things, making the same mistakes, struggling with the same problems week after week? So at the end of the week, before you review your mission statement and the longer-term context, before you organize the next week, train yourself to ask these questions. What goals did I achieve? What challenges did I encounter? What decisions did I make? In making these decisions, did I truly keep first things first? Did I fulfill the goals under each role that I selected? With this final step, the Quadrant 2 process becomes a living and learning cycle that literally creates an upward spiral of growth. As we focus more on contributing than on consuming, we create the context that makes peace in all aspects of life possible. It's in leaving a legacy that we find meaning in living, loving, and learning. We are not laws unto ourselves, and the more we begin to value principles and people, the greater will be our peace. Becoming principle-centered is just that, becoming. It's not arriving. It's a lifetime quest. As I conclude this audio program on First Things First, the spirit that fills my mind and heart is one of reverence. I feel a deep reverence for people. As many have shared parts of their deep inner lives with me in the form of mission statements, goals, and personal experiences in working with the principles of this program, I've honestly had the feeling that I've stood on holy ground. My mind has been drawn to cultures in the world where people greet others with palms pressed together, and a slight bow in acknowledgement of that reverence for the nobility of the human soul, for that spark of divinity within us all. I feel a sense of reverence also for principles themselves, my own experience in living in harmony with them, and also, frankly, in violating them, has given me a deep and abiding respect for their reality, and a conviction that quality of life absolutely depends on the degree to which we align our lives with True North. Above all, I feel a sense of reverence for God, whom I believe to be the source of both principles and conscience. It is my own conviction that it is the spark of divinity within each of us that draws us toward principle-centered lives of service and contribution and integrity. But I also recognize and revere the diversity of belief manifest in my own organization and also throughout the entire world by people of conscience and contribution. As one of the early pioneers of the American West, Bryant S. Hinckley said, "Service is the virtue that distinguishes the great of all times and which they will be remembered by. It places a mark of nobility upon its disciples. It is the dividing line which separates the two great groups of the world, those who help and those who hinder, those who lift and those who lean, those who contribute and those who only consume. How much better it is to give than to receive. Service in any form is comely and beautiful. To give encouragement, to impart sympathy, to show interest, to banish fear, to build self-confidence, and awaken hope in the hearts of others, in short, to love them and to show it, is to render the most precious service." End of quote. It is our earnest hope that all of us will continually strive to leave such a legacy in a world that needs it so desperately.
First Things First was written by Stephen R. Covey, A. Roger Merrill, and Rebecca R. Merrill. It was read by Stephen Covey. It was abridged for audio by Lauren B. Church. Editing and post-production by Dave Levan of Norwood Productions. The associate producer was Linda Wolman. First Things First was produced and directed by Susan Perrin-Totland. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.